All right. Thanks for being here. Hope you're in the right place. We're trying to look at the issue of ministry and revolving doors, practical challenges and ideas for ministry in a mobile society. I wasn't clever enough to come up with the topic of this seminar on my own. So Don Carson came up with this topic and thought that I would be the appropriate person to present it, since I am in a very hypermobile city in Boston. So I just had to, Don Carson asks you to do something, you just say yes, sir, and you do it. And then I've had to do some research, but it's been a very interesting exercise for me, and I'm in the process of speaking with some publishers to develop this into a book. It's just expanding my paper, and I really think that when we think about urban ministry, and I realize not all of you are from urban contexts, but we know that whatever happens in the city affects everything that happens outside the city. What happens in the halls of an elite university in Boston will affect the farm boy in Iowa. This is not to diminish that person's work or value. That's just the influence of culture. And therefore, we need to understand these real effects of mobility, which we find in urban centers. And so we'll be looking at that. But when you've looked at some of the issues related to urban ministry within the last 30, 40 years, they've talked primarily about issues related to inner city ministry. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's unimportant. I mean, we're a center city church in Boston, but we do all sorts of ministries of mercy and social justice and action within our city, not only addressing issues of marginalized people, but hopefully bringing about cultural renewal and addressing systemic problems of homelessness and things like that, not just addressing behavioristic problems that we see. And so this is a responsibility, I believe, not only for the city and the state, but also for the church, although some people disagree with me on that theologically, and that's a completely different seminar. But I think when we think about the effects of globalization, we need to understand that there are larger issues that we must confront as a church. And I believe that the issues related to mobility are very, very important. You might not realize it. You might not even realize that you're being entrepreneurial and progressive and pioneering just by virtue of being in this seminar. You might be here out of default. I don't know. But I believe that within the next 20, 30 years, this will be a very, very vitally important topic and issue. Because everyone else in private sectors have recognized this to be the case. That's why they use words like transnationalization. They use words like globalization. They use words like urbanality. And they recognize this already. But the church is, as usually is the case, 20, 30 years behind some of these trends. Now, I know you're thinking, oh, but are we driven by Scripture, and should we not have a theological grid and framework and a biblical worldview that we ought not to react to the trends that we see in culture? Absolutely, and I'm actually going to try to show you that this is a biblical model, that the Bible had to address issues of mobility, and the early church was an extremely hypermobile, was being established in a very hypermobile context. And when you think about God's movement, even in redemptive history, all the way back with his people in Israel, that it's not by coincidence that he was a God who would reveal himself, his presence and his glory, while they were traveling throughout the wilderness. And God is very, very hyper-mobile. God, right? He is not limited to one particular geographic setting. So if you were to go to, I hope all of you have the outline, they're available for you in the back, but if you go to page 9, Harvey Kahn, who has helped me to understand, a mentor, who has helped me to understand these thoughts about a biblical theology for mobility, this is what he writes in the second paragraph, which I have italicized, underlined for you. This is what he writes as he quotes a block and others. He writes, "This territorial transcendence of Israel's Yahweh would stand out in missionary contrast to the geocentric orientation of the gods whose cities the Israelites would occupy. Those urban deities were primarily attached to specific geographic territories and only secondarily concerned with the inhabitants of these areas. And then one sentence after that. In contrast, Yahweh had chosen Israel to be the special objects of his love. But this God of the Hebrews was also the God of all the earth, Isaiah 54:5. So we see from the very beginning, not only in the New Testament, but also in the Old Testament, that you have a God who is the God of the entire earth. Talks about stretching the tent in terms of having a picture of how he will bring the fulfillment of his redemptive works, not only for Israel, but for all nations, right? So let's look here. Let me just give you the brief outline for where I want to go, and hopefully we can have a Q&A session. I'd be more than willing to field some questions. So the first thing is we're going to look at the mobility and urbanization in the early church. And we'll look at three individuals. A New Testament historian out of Yale, Wayne Meeks, has written an excellent a book on this, which needs to be updated, and I think he's in the process of doing that. And the second one is written by an extremely competent sociology of religion, sociologist of religion. His name is Rodney Stark. I think he's still teaching at Baylor. And then the third one is some observation made by Tim Keller. And then the second main idea, I would like for us to look at the features of mobility in today's culture. So we'll look at social mobility. We'll look at the issues of egality and meritocracy as opposed to and aristocracy. We'll look at capital and economic mobility. We'll look at some of the thoughts given to us by Saskia Sassen in her three books, the great political scientist out of Chicago. And then the third thing is we'll look at geographic mobility and the issues of urbanality. Okay, so we'll look at globality, we'll look at egality, we'll look at urbanality, and at one point we'll look at plurality, and to show you that the present circumstances that we have in our world, and in probably in the setting that you're in doing your ministry, is very, very similar to the features and the dynamics of the development of the early church. And so we can actually, in a sense, replicate what we find in the book of Acts, because our present social location is so much more closely associated with the development of the early church than any other historic period. Okay, so that's exciting because this is not just a strategic model for the church to respond to trendy movements in our society, but it's actually biblically rooted. Okay, so that's what we're going to try to see, and I'm sure that's why you're here, because you are not people who want to over-adapt and be assimilationists. On the other hand, you don't want to under-contextualize and be evasive people. You want to know how you can have a biblically, theologically, a rooted foundation, a gospel foundation, a biblical foundation, and how that informs every dimension of life and every feature in your ministry for the local church. And I believe, once again, if you're doing ministry around a metropolitan urban area or in a suburb that's close to an urban setting, or if you're involved in university ministries, and university, the university comes from two words, unity and diversity, right? Now, obviously, we don't have true university. They're all pluriversities because there's no coherence. But university is a microcosmic picture of the city. And the city represents culture. The Garden of Eden was an urban-centric a setting where God established his work for redemption. Right? Now, I don't want to defend that here, but I believe that God essentially started with the city and he ends with the city. Right? You look at the features of the tree of life and the river of life in Genesis, and you see that in Revelation 22 with the New Jerusalem. So this is not to dismiss, and I know this sounds a little bit like city propaganda, and you know that I have an overrealized view of an urban-centric way of looking at God's redemption, but I do believe that God's work in redemption is essentially urban-centric. And whatever happens in the city, and it's not by coincidence that every single major church planted was in an urban center. That was Paul's urban strategy. That was God's strategy. And so, therefore, we need to understand the features of mobility and see how we can help our folks wrestling with these issues. Okay, so that's kind of the outline. Oh, and the third thing here is then we'll look at how to respond to mobility. And then lastly, we'll look at practical suggestions and ideas and challenges. Okay, does that sound okay? All right, so let's start here. First of all, the entire book of Acts describes the development and the geographic expansion of the New Testament church, right? That's what the book of Acts is about. It's not a manual on church planning. It's not even a manual for addressing the issues of mobility. It's about the geographic expansion of the New Testament church. And so if you break it up structurally, you'll see these creases or panels from one part of the missionary work moving on to another setting, starting in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And you see this being unfolded. And of course, it is only a picture of the Western diaspora. You know, there was an Eastern diaspora too. It's just not recorded for us. Tradition says that Thomas went all the way over to India and was ultimately buried in the city of Madras. And so what we find here is that the Western diaspora, which faced the issues of mobility, globality, urbanality, and religious plurality, were things that we find here. And so this is what Wayne Meeks has to say, as he quotes Martin Hengel. He writes, "The guiding thread for every history of earliest Christianity is the irresistible expansions of the Christian faith in the Mediterranean region during the first 120 years. And that expansion was closely associated with personal mobility, both physical and social." And listen to what Hawk writes. He has calculated that Paul traveled nearly 10,000 miles during his reported career, which put him on roads busy with government officials, traders, pilgrims, the sick, letter carriers, sightseers, runaway slaves, fugitives, prisoners, athletes, artisans, teachers, and students. And so some of this travel was undertaken specifically for a Christian mission. Others were done within the context of traveling because a person had a particular professional calling to be engaged in this. And of course, the rise of the Roman Empire, looking at some of the historical background for this, the military presence and the way they control the piracy on the sea at making it a minimum issue helped people to travel on these routes with a great amount of ease. And so Craig Blomberg in his book writes that there are six major factors, and I want to highlight two here. He writes, the first, you have the development of transportation and communication, which was essential for developing the early church, and a cosmopolitan spirit group, particularly in the cities that transcended national barriers. Old tribal distinctions and identities were breaking down, leaving people ripe for new religions or ideologies to fill the gaps. And of course, that is also for Christianity as well. So you have the effects of mobility in the context of the early church. And then, listen to what Rodney Stark writes. He he's a very, very helpful sociologist because, like any good sociologist, he actually provides some demographic statistical information. And he has taken 31 Greco-Roman cities having a population of 30,000 or more around 100 CE. And then he shows how about 66% of them were Christian. The word pagan, tradition says, derived from the word paganos, which was a term that was used to refer to country dwellers. The word Christian was synonymous with an urban person. And now, once again, I know that this sounds like city propaganda, that sort of thing, but this is not to diminish. Please don't misunderstand me. Sometimes I get a little passionate and excited about what God's doing in cities. But especially in the last 30 years, you have seen, although there's been a change and a shift of many people going back into cities, that you have seen churches who have left cities, some for legitimate reasons, right? That you just couldn't find the proper real estate to establish a church building. It was more expensive to buy in the city than to buy something right outside the city. And once again, I mean, some of these reasons were legitimate, but what we find here is that there are many young folks, especially, who are going back into cities. And I believe in order for us to bring real cultural renewal, Christians must live and work in cities. Not only in cities, but we really need to see this happening, and I think that I see a positive signs to that end. He writes, despite the fact that about 98% of his population lived in farms or in tiny rural villages, Rome was an urban empire. And he writes in another book, The Rise of Christianity, Christianity was an urban movement, and the New Testament was set down by urbanites. Remember, when you were living in an extremely densely populated setting, then the more people that you have, the easier it would be for diseases to be spread from one individual to another. And whenever there were issues like this, all of them would flee. They would flee from being in a densely populated area, but Christians stayed. Even to the point of sacrificing their lives for caring for people within the context of cities. And if we can make a modern comparison, people who have a concern for maybe very fragmented, broken, marginalized people, that we don't have to see that and be afraid of that or run away from that, but to see in what powerful ways that we can stand as a witness for the gospel. Okay, so Keller kind of summarizes all this, and this is what he has to write. So let's look on page 2. The 21st century is becoming a globalized, urbanized, and post-secular world again. In other words, the 21st century is more like the first century than any other centuries in between the two. There is now a mobility of ideas, people, capital, unprecedented since the Pax Romana. As Wayne Meeks puts it, travel through the Pax Romana was easier than it had ever been and ever was again until the 19th century. So Antioch was really, right, that's ultimately the first Christian center after Jerusalem, was really a United Nations with Asian, African, Jewish, Greek, and Roman sections. From Antioch, there were powerful networks that led back into three continents. And Paul's mission strategy was remarkably urban-centric, right? So therefore, since there was a very cosmopolitan spirit that grew, that gives an opportunity for the gospel to flourish. So you have many young people who proclaim to be skeptics, or people in general living in cities who are skeptics, they're open to new ideas. That is why church plants are thriving in city centers. Whereas if you have it in a context where people are more inclined to be associated with traditional values, then they're not going to be able to have the innovative, strategic, imaginative heart to accommodate change. But in cities, because of mobility and globalization, this is something that we're accustomed to and that we see every day. And so let's get to our second Roman numeral, features of mobility in today's culture. Social upward mobility. That is emphasizing egality or a meritocracy as opposed to an aristocracy. You see, this is what sociologists will say. They'll talk about class systems. They'll talk about an intergenerational mobility. So if you are part of a certain high social class, then by virtue of being born into that class system, that you're also going to inherit that class system. So if your father were to be recognized as somebody who was noble, by virtue of being born into that nobility, you know, whether you were competent, whether you were a classy person, it really didn't matter. You were viewed as somebody who would be categorized in that class system. But you see, with social upward mobility, it gets rid of the intergenerational mobility, and it introduces an intra-generational mobility, where meritocracy is emphasized, not an aristocracy. So when you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Corinth was a very, very new city. And you didn't have these classes. You don't have the intergenerational classes of people being born in nobility, right? Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, none of you was born in a noble class. All of you have made it through your competence and through your gifting, coming here and working diligently, I'm sure, to establish your trade. And it is a very meritocratic context. And you have thrived in that situation. So social upward mobility can emphasize equality. You're not just born into it, right? That is kind of the American dream. You have immigrants who come from different parts of the world coming into this culture hoping that if they work hard enough, that it's not just about an aristocracy, but a meritocracy. And secondly, through capital economic mobility and through globality, there are the effects of financial structures, right? This is what some of your interests, Saskia Sassen talks about, the geographic dispersal of manufacturing, the mobility of capital. This is what she writes. An important aspect of the mobility of capital is the transnationalization in the ownership and control of major corporations through foreign direct investment, mergers and acquisitions, and joint ventures. In other words, I don't know if any of you have seen the book written by Richard Florida, The Rise of the Creative Class. Well, he's come up with a sequel entitled The Flight of the Creative Class. It came out several months ago. And what's interesting about that that book and the observations that he makes is that the greatest resource that we have in North America is what? Human resources, right? We emphasize Yankee ingenuity, right? Innovation. Right? And this is what we're about. And therefore, many other nations and global world-class urban centers recognize this. So they're coming here to recruit, right, the human resources. And therefore, because of mobility, because of the ease for one individual to move from New York to Chicago to London to Boston to DC, that they see no problems moving to London, to Berlin, to Paris, to Tokyo, or to Shanghai. And so what we're finding here is that people are coming and they are trying to recruit the greatest human resource that we have, which is people, and that is the flight of the creative class. And therefore, because of this flight, you have the changing of the mobility of capital through joint ventures and transnationalization, or as Anthony Appiah has written from Harvard, he writes, the global cities are important in part as points of control and centers of finances of great transnational economic empires. In other words, we no longer have national boundaries. There is an intense hypermobility of capital and geography. This is the world that we're living in. Okay? And I mean, you can look at this and say, oh, okay, I mean, this is what's happening. These are the social trends and issues of mobility. But hey, we just want to be a local church, and we don't want to necessarily respond to that. Whether we like it or not, we need to respond to it. You see, whether you are completely opposed to technology, remember, technology is neutral. No matter if you have this posture where you're against technology, well, you're just going to miss opportunities to do effective ministry, to use it for good. And it's the same thing with the issues of mobility. Because mobility in and of itself is not intrinsically evil. Right? We see that in the Old Testament. We see that the moving of the tabernacle. We see that God is the God of the entire world. You see this with the establishment of the early church. It's not just a modern phenomenon. And therefore, it's going to be here and it's going to leave us at some point. No, it is something that's been around for ages. And we need to know how we can engage in fruitful ministry within that context. And the last thing in this section is geographic mobility, effects of spatial structures, and issues of urbanality, right? Population movements. Well, let me give you some basic facts which many of you might be familiar with. In the year 1800, less than 2% of the world's population lived in urban centers. In the year 1900, about 8%. In the year 2000, over 55% of the world's population lives in urban centers. 55%. And that's only rising. And in other words, everything is converging into urban centers. And through the effects of globalization, these are features that we find, and we must come to terms with these things. Okay? So the third main point here, I want us to look at how we can respond to mobility, right? Because some of you might have come here swanning the practical suggestions and ideas, but you always need to build a foundation. You can't just go there, right? I mean, you can't just talk about how the person ought to have a gospel moral ethic without going back to the indicative, right? The indicative precedes the imperative. You need to talk about the foundation of the gospel before you can tell them why they ought to live their lives a certain way. Well, that's the same. It's just my apology for doing this in the first section here. Because I can't just assume that. Okay, I need to be able to establish that and root it within the context of what I find in Scripture, although we haven't been able to look at particular Scriptures in depth here. And so now we're going to respond, and we'll have some practical suggestions, okay? So should we just hate mobility in our culture? Most of you are here because you probably have a very nice, balanced, robust philosophy of cultural engagement, right? So usually people will simply critique culture or critique mobility, or they will completely buy into it or accommodate it. But what is the gospel response? Okay, and I think that there are three ways for us to look at this, right? Three ways to look at it. Number one, we're going to look at idolatries, because clearly there are idolatries that are wrapped around hypermobility. And secondly, we're going to look at realities. And this might be a surprise to you, because there are certain things that are part of mobility which are, you can't do anything about it. They're just realities. And you can't just assume that everything has to do with some sort of an idolatrous bent. Okay? And then lastly, we're going to look at opportunities. Okay? So let's look here. I'm on page 3 on the bottom, responding to mobility idolatries. Here's my working definition. When some functional god, master, occupies a position of authority in a person's heart so that the object of his over-desire, okay, that's my definition of epithumia, okay? When we think of lust, we tend to think of lust just kind of in a fleshly, physical, sexual sense. Well, no, I mean, it can be lust for anything. It's an over-desire, or as Calvin has said, an inordinate amount of desire for anything. That something that is intrinsically good can be elevated, as even Tim Keller mentioned yesterday, to an ultimate as an ultimate value where that becomes more important than God or Christ or the gospel in your life. Right? So it's a preoccupation. It controls every aspect or every dimension of your life. Okay, so we're going to look at idolatries. And I have a nice little quote here. You can look at it later from Screwtape Letters, where Screwtape talks to Wormwood about irregular church going. Right? Josh should have used this for his seminar on church hopping. But it goes like this. This is what he says to the lieutenant devil here. He says, if a man can't be cured of church going, the next best thing is send him all over the neighborhood looking for the church that suits him until he becomes a taster or a connoisseur of churches. In other words, if you can't derail him from leaving the church altogether, then let him just be a taster. Let him just kind of go from one place to another and never committing to a local church, right? And so sometimes the idolatrous aspects of mobility will be wrapped around an issue like this. So he tells him, so pray, bestir yourself, and send this fool the round of the neighboring churches as soon as possible. So that's your work. Have him never commit. Have her never really engage in building community anywhere, but just have her go around from one place to another. So let me list some idolatries of mobility. Okay? So we're here on page 4. Consumerism, right? Because look what Lewis writes. He says, an individual who's looking for the church that suits him. Through membership, when we go through the membership seminars, and I have my staff people doing this, I used to do this in the beginning, and I would tell them that, let them know right from the beginning, we're going to disappoint you as a church. Right? Because some people are coming with all sorts of expectations. Oh, I had these issues with the leadership here. I had issues with people here. And, you know, and they come here with all this expectation that we're going to be the savior church that will help them and bring them to glory. Well, you've got to help them to realize, you know, we're broken, we're flawed, we're sinful, right? I mean, and if you become a member right? That only proves our point that you're going to add to the depravity of our church, right? The one prerequisite of being a member of our church is that you're a sinner. And so if you're coming here with a consumer mindset and saying, oh, what's going to suit me? This is what I like, and I want it this way. Well, the church is not about ice cream flavors, right? It's not like we're coming here with a personal preference. You want to know whether or not the church is going to help you to become a holistic disciple of Jesus Christ, being able to understand the centrality of the gospel. It is not only about the power of God, but it is the power of God. So when the preached word is going forth, that the work is being done on the spot, and that you will be transformed, not just informed, but through the work of the Spirit, through the preached word, that sort of effect will have on your life. And therefore, radically reprogramming and reorienting the DNA and the fabric of yourself and your identity so that you understand your status before God is in the performance of Christ and not in your own. And therefore, the formation of your identity development, which is in Christ, will allow you to be radically gracious and generous to other people. And your heart will be moved in such a way where you will have amazing affection for the things of God. It's not about consumerism. And therefore, if the person who is engaged in economic or a capital mobility has this kind of mindset of being a consumer and going places that will suit his own felt needs, then they are not considering kingdom priorities, but they're moving where the next profit is going to be. They're being governed and driven by where they're going to be able to make the greatest profit. And therefore, money becomes an idol in this person's heart. So, and this is not to suggest, I mean, in our church, let's see, about 10 to 12% of people in our church every 12 months leave. 10 to 12%. I mean, that's Boston for you, is it not? But by God's grace, we have about 24% or 25% new people coming all the time, so we're incrementally growing every year. But what we find here is that some people, they don't even align their decisions with kingdom priorities, and they'll just simply go where the most amount of money is offered. And so we have to address the idols. This is not to say that God can't call them to another city, but you have to challenge their idols. Number two, idolatry. Professional mobility. Advancement, status, influence, power, comfort, approval, training, education. So career becomes an idol. Right? That's related to the first thing. Third idolatry is autonomy, right? Autonomy is wanting the freedom to do whatever without being tied down. Right? And this younger generation is all about freedom, of course, right? About my own autonomy and my choice. And so let me just make an aside theological statement here. And that is, when you're talking about sin, right? The Bible describes sin in many different ways. And we tend to think that the moral category for defining sin is the dominant category. It's not. When we talk about wrongness versus rightness, actually the Bible describes sin in a more detailed way in the context of the enslavement freedom category. And I think that is very, very helpful for people who are hypermobile, who are professional people, who are in bondage to their idols, for you to not simply tell them, oh, this is wrong, this is right. Got to address kingdom priorities. No, you have to say, if you pursue this track and you're going to be enslaved by your career, and these young professionals do not want to be enslaved to anything. They want their autonomy. They want to be free. And if that is the case, then you have to encourage them through the preaching of God's word and the promises of the gospel, which power is going to enslave you and which power is going to free you. And that's what you need to present to them. And so autonomy is another idol. Freedom becomes an idol. Number four, escapism, leaving it all behind, a chance to start over, go to a new city, right? So people are in and out of relationships, so they were wounded through a relationship. Right? A lot of young people, you know, very touchy, sensitive. And so they're wounded in a relationship. They're like, oh, I got to leave the place. Well, what did the city do to you? I mean, it's the person, all right? If the person wounded your heart, don't blame the city, right? I mean, the city might still be a great place to be, but it's their way of saying, oh, I got to get away. I've got to escape, and I've got to start all over. And what ends up happening is that they start making decisions, and the decisions establish a trend. They're at a place for a year and a half. And they can't establish relationships, right? So they'll go to church and say, oh, you know, this church is cold. And are you establishing any initiatives to build deep relationships and not relying on just social networks and trying to have relationships online? Once again, social networks are fine if they support offline relationships, right? Can't become a substitute. And so no wonder you're just involved in a social network. The relationships are superficial. They're not very deep. There's nothing sticky about it. People aren't going to be in your face speaking the truth in love. There's no accountability. Because if you don't like what the other person is saying online, then that person is no longer part of your social network. And so people will do that. They'll go to a church. Oh, they're wounded. Oh, I got to move. I'll go to another community. Well, guess what? You're going to go there and you're going to get wounded there. And the reason why you're so touchy is because you don't, first of all, you have a misunderstanding of the condition of the human heart, and also that you're not understanding the potential of the power of the gospel to transform those friends of yours who seem to be wounding you. And so therefore, comfort becomes an idol. And can I just make a side comment here for many of you who are in ministry, and I'm saying this even to my own heart. This becomes an idol for us too. It is always easier to escape. We've got some dragons in our leadership. We've got people who are giving us hard times. And the easy thing is to say, oh, my time is up here. God's calling me to be somewhere else. Well, maybe God's not calling you to be somewhere else, but you're not being courageous enough, and you're not addressing the issue and graciously and winsomely, but courageously speaking the truth in love and confronting, right? If I could just generalize here, men, right? We generally are conflict avoiders, right? We withdraw and we don't want to deal with that. But we need to address this even to our own hearts. Lastly, personal relational development. That relationships are too important. A lot of single people in our church, right? Our church, I guess I didn't tell you where I'm from, but you probably have at least done some profiling on me. And that our church is in Center City, Boston, which means that we are indigenous. Your church ought to be indigenous, okay? So rather than saying, oh, this is the trendy thing, this is kind of the sexy thing, and so we use all of these categories, I don't like to do that. People say, what's your church about? Is it ethnic-specific, multi-ethnic, you know, dominant, or whatever? I just say, oh, we're just indigenous. We just represent our community, and which means Center City, Boston, you've got a racially mixed group of people, single, right, desperately wanting to be in relationships, though, aspirational, professional, and so that's what we have, and so a lot of young folks, they'll meet somebody, right? This is the reason why they love going to weddings, and many of them aren't at church every week because they're always going to a wedding every other week, but they're going there because they want to find somebody and cultivate a relationship, and because of mobility, they can just kind of do this long distance relationship, although it really doesn't work very well, the relationship becomes too important. So rather than making a commitment, so this is what I tell the people, young, I want my single people to be married if God's calling them to be married, right? I mean, being single in and of itself is a beautiful thing if that's what God calls you to do, right? Paul, 1 Corinthians 7, if that's God's call for you. But, and a lot of single people will come and say, oh, I don't know, I don't want to receive this call. What if I receive this call? I say, if you're worrying about it, you have not received the call, all right? You know, you just got to be patient, all right? And so what ends up happening is that they're willing to abandon everything, their work, their commitment to the local church, just to follow a relationship. And, you know, there are idolatrous aspects of approaching anything like that. I tell our young couples that I tell the men, the husbands, you know, God did not give you your wife to be your redeemer. Certainly didn't give her to you to be your mother either, but certainly not to be your redeemer. And she's been given to you so that there will be more holiness in your relationship than happiness, right? As some people rightly say, it's not about I scratch your back this way and you reciprocate. And no, it's just not about that. Even if I'm meeting someone's needs and that person does not reciprocate, I still need to love that person, right? That's the gospel. And the other thing is self-help. And so what we've got here is that we have to make sure that people do not emphasize personal relationships, because they're so lonely and they're wrestling with these issues, above their commitment to kingdom priorities. And of course, I tell all our single people, okay, if you're going to do that and you really need to be committed to this relationship, then that other person needs to come to Boston. Okay, that's the way it has to happen, not the other way. And secondly, realities. Right, those are some of the idols. And here are some of the realities: busyness, okay, transience, 2-year graduate program, med school, law school, education, residency, work-related travel, visitors. Right, these are all realities of a transient society that is very, very highly competent, educated, and proficient. We're living in an expert culture. And so you can't try to dismiss that as saying, oh, you know, you're just all about being consumed with your career. No, what if God has called that individual to be an attorney, or called that person to be an educator, or called that person to go into the healthcare industry? Right? They've got to respond to that call, and that's just the realities. And so you have to make sure that you don't guilt trip somebody because they're there for 2 to 3 years and they need to move on. Okay, and so people are involved in time-consuming professions such as the healthcare industry. Higher percentage of singles. And singles, if you go to every urban center, high percentage of singles, right? New York is 75%, Boston is 75%. And they're going to be more mobile, right? And also because most of them can't afford decent housing in the center, a part of the city, that they're going to have to move on and be somewhat mobile outside. So there's mobility even there within the context of the city. And globalization, new global competition for talent, as I mentioned, Florida mentioned this. And fragmentation, people's story plotline is broken with many fragmented social spheres pulling the individual. In other words, people's lives are more complicated. Right, before you grew up in a village, if your father had a particular trade, most likely that's what you inherited. But you don't have that anymore, right? You don't have an intergenerational mobility, but you have an intra-generational mobility where it's all about a meritocracy. You can have somebody growing up in a particular rural place and saying, you know what? God has given me the gift of singing, and I want to go to the city to make it as a singer. That's a great thing. And then they show up in the city, in the subways of New York City or the subways of Boston, and realize that the singer singing in the subways is more talented than the person who has just come into the city. But that's where they want to be. That's where all of the competition is. And life has become a little bit more complicated. It's very, very different than traditional cultures. Now go to page 5. We'll go another 14 minutes or so, and I'll take questions. This is a chart that some of our staff members we put together, and I think it's helpful. Looking at ministry as gardening, right? The great law of returns that we see in Galatians 6. And when you look at mobility this way, it's very, very helpful. It's helped me. And that is, you have on one level the weather, the climate. That's the work of the Spirit. You can't control that. John chapter 3, the Spirit comes and goes as he pleases, right? I mean, we can't control it, right? The Greek word there, dunamai, is used about 7 or 8 times. The point is, you are not able, Nicodemus, you are not able. But the Spirit is able, the Spirit can. You cannot, the Spirit can. You cannot, the Spirit can. Right? The Spirit comes and goes as he pleases. So that's the climate. That's something that is out of our control. And the other thing, the bottom layer, is the soil. That is our context. That's our life setting. That's our system leben. You know, that's our life setting. There's nothing that we can do about our context. I can't change the fact that Boston is 75% single. Not that I would want to change, but the point is that that's a reality, right? This is not an idolatry. It's a reality. And I can't change the fact that it is an academic center. over 300,000 university students within a 20-mile radius, over 50 colleges and universities, perhaps the greatest academic center in all of North America, right? I can't change that. That is the fabric of what we are, the healthcare industry, pharmaceutical companies. Boston is that. I can't change that. And I can't control that. But what I can control by God's grace is the second part, that is gardening. That is my stewardship, how I cultivate the garden. Okay? So when we think about the realities of mobility, you need to understand you can't control the weather and you can't control the soil. So if you're beating yourself up and saying, it's like 90% students. Let's say you're in a place in Austin, Texas. Oh, it's just like 90% students. There's so much mobility and all that. Don't beat yourself up. The reality is what it is, in the words of Bill Belichick. It is what it is. I mean, you've got to accept it. And you've got to recognize it and build good strategic systems to be able to address some of the idolatries and to speak the gospel effectively into the lives of those folks. So what is not under your control? Soil conditions. And secondly, weather conditions. Let's go to page 6. So let's go to the practical suggestions as we wrap up here. Practical suggestions for mobility. So we finally got to where we want to be. The first is addressing idolatries. You need to preach consistently to all idolatries. That is what you must do. You must do it consistently. So it is not like you have a sermon on idolatry, but every single time when you are addressing the human condition, right? You can't get to grace without showing that people are broken and sinful, right? I mean, you have to show that grace is necessary. You have to show that the finished work, the vicarious, representative, federal headship work of Jesus Christ is absolutely necessary in providing us atonement. Not only to take away our sins, but also to propitiate God's holiness. All of these things are necessary. But you must first address the issues of the human condition. And you need to get to the idols underneath the idols. You must get underneath the sin underneath the sin. You can't address the issues of money, but you must get to the heart. Why do people have so much a drive for money? Well, because they probably want to know that they're very valuable. They want to know that there is net value, that they are significant, that they're consequential, not inconsequential, that they're valuable, not invaluable, that they're significant, not insignificant. They want to know that deep inside, that they have something more than just a bummishness, right? Rocky, remember? The reason why we love Rocky is if I know I can go the distance and I'll know that I'm not a bum. Right? There's a bummishness within our hearts. And there is this incurable suspicion that perhaps that's who we really are. Why do you think the Susan Boyle story, 40 million hits on YouTube? Why? You look at this kind of frumpish, dowdy, woman. And what's the point? The point is that that's trendy. She'll come and go, and she'll be gone in another week or so. But the whole point is that we know deep within our hearts there's a frumpishness. There's a dowdiness that we feel completely insecure. Of course, we don't want to be like this individual who's completely unconventional, but we know deep inside that she represents a story deep within our hearts, right? And so we must preach consistently addressing the issues of idolatries, money, escapism, status-seeking, approval. And therefore, you must do that with the ministry of the word and also with the ministry of deed, active social justice ministry, as I mentioned earlier, and also addressing vocational, professional, personal development issues. That is, first of all, I'll use this opportunity. If they are so committed to their careers and to vocation, what do I do? Do I just simply say, hey, hate your career? The only way you're going to serve God is to go overseas and do missions work and all that. And you're really doing this because you just got to make money? No, of course not. I give them a biblical theology of work. I tell them that work preceded the fall. Work is not the result of the fall. Right? Adam was called to what? Cultivate the land. To be an architect, to be a vice regent, to be a gardener, to be a priest. He was called to do these things. He had work. Work is intrinsically good. Guess what? God is a worker. He worked for 6 days, then he rested on the seventh day. In other words, I want to use this opportunity, even though they might have idolatrous tendencies and loving their career and work more than God, I want to use that opportunity to show them that it's important for you to know that work is important. However, you can't be consumed by it. It can't become your God. That is why God said, work, rest, work, rest. Work. He gave us the cycle, work and rest. And recognizing that the responsibility that you've been given has been given so that you can serve for the glory of God. And so I'll use that opportunity. I'll also use that opportunity to talk about faith and work integration and addressing marketplace issues. You can't simply tell them just read your Bibles and pray, although that's important. That's very important. It's essential, vital. But they need to know how reading the scriptures and reflecting and meditating on the Word of God, how that establishes a Christian biblical gospel worldview so that it will affect every dimension of life. Otherwise, they're only going to know their commitment to God in an isolated event on Sundays, maybe midweek meeting, if you have that. But outside of that, they don't see the connection between the gospel and the marketplace. They don't see that. And so those will be some of the issues. Now, the realities, you can take a look at that later. I just expanded a little bit about some of the things that you can do about effectiveness. And let me just get to the last part here, and I'll wrap up. Opportunities. Opportunities. We're living in an expert culture, okay? People who are highly skilled. Now, I can already hear some of your voices. You're saying, this is you already said we're not about consumerism. It seems as though you're saying, hey, this is the audience, they're an expert culture, and therefore you need to respond to the expert culture. No, I'm talking about contextualization issues. I'm not placing a value on this. I'm just realizing that this is what we have in our culture, and we need to realize how can we strategically and effectively and fruitfully contextualize our ministry to reach a highly skilled, extremely busy, intelligent audience. Okay, and here are some suggestions. People expect intelligent, unabashedly intellectual teaching. Let me qualify that. Because I'm not talking about scholasticism. I'm not talking about intellectualism, which is an idol in and of itself. I'm talking about clearly and reasonably explaining, having credibility and plausibility, the consistent biblical message from deep theological study. In other words, I think that we are in a situation today where, not that this wasn't the case in the past, where ministers need to be well prepared. It's an expert culture. You can't just quote somebody somewhere without having done some preliminary research, because you're going to have a postdoc fellow who's doing work in astrophysical stuff, and he's going to come up to you and say, oh, what did you mean by that statement? I don't know. Which statement are you talking about? I remember I made a brief reference to Carlos Frank's comments. After they found the COBE satellite findings, right? Some of you have seen this in the early 1990s. Stephen Hawking said it was like looking into the face of God, and he's somebody who's known for understatement. All English people are. And in other words, I was trying to show the bigness of God, right? And I was trying to show that according to the astronomical evidence, that 95% of cosmologists and astronomers are at least deists or theists. You don't have atheistic cosmologists and astronomers anymore. Why? They see too much design. It just doesn't make sense to them that something can come from nothing. It just doesn't make sense philosophically, never mind scientifically. And so I threw a quote out there, right? So I have this postdoc fellow who comes, right? Who's doing research in astrophysical something from some elite school in Boston. And he wasn't trying to be a smart aleck. And he just said, oh, what did you mean there when you made this comment and all that? And all of a sudden, you're thinking, oh, did I do enough? I'm granted, I'm not going to be able to understand the issues as well as this individual. But what I'm trying to say is that for somebody who's a scientist, it is our responsibility at least to do some research if we're talking about the issue. Now, whether you understand it or not, people who are the audience, the people at your churches, want to know that at least you're an expert on the Bible. They don't expect you to be a Bible scholar, but they expect theological study. They expect that you're wrestling with a text. They want to know whether or not this haughty phrase is being used in a declarative sense or as a grounds. Maybe. And you need to be able to look at the text carefully and to chew on it, to reflect on it, meditate on it, look at all the commentaries, and for you to be able to present a message that is very consistent with the authorial intent. And that is what I mean. If all of these people are highly skilled, then in other words, I just say this very humbly, we can't be lazy in our presentation, especially with the ministry of the word. That's what I'm saying, because it's very easy to just kind of go up there and reprocess something that we've done in the past. And I really think that our people need for us to be well prepared. Okay. So we have to do the exegesis of the text as well as exegeting our culture. Secondly, people literally live in their careers. So the ministry implications and ideas, greater interest here than anywhere else for faith and work integration, as I mentioned earlier. So this could be an opportunity for you to perhaps establish groups, affinity groups. I'm not a big fan of affinity groups, but if a bunch of attorneys want to get together and have some sort of a small group talking about issues of ethics and law and whatnot from a Christian worldview, then this is a wonderful place for them to be able to do that. Okay? Also, people are sexually active. Right? Single people, urban context. So what do you do? Right? You know, there are one of two ways for you to do this. Just be silent on the matter. Right? Just pretend that people are not engaged in sexual promiscuity and premarital sex. 75% single people, right? You know, with a lot of passion, right? Young and youthful passion and with all sorts of epithumia over desires. And so, yeah, only in Boston, yeah. In Boston, more overly charged, yeah? Yeah, yeah. And that's one way, just be silent about it, just pretend it's not happening. Or you can just beat people up with it, right? And I think that we ought to take the biblical approach. That is, on the one hand, the Bible has a lack of prudishness about sex. Read the Song of Solomon. Right, the Hebrew translators kind of wimped out on certain places. The husband is completely sexually aroused in front of his wife, which is a beautiful thing. Sex is a gift from God. It's just been tarnished by our culture and by the flesh. And so you want to show that the Bible has a high view of sex, right? So I remember hearing an illustration many years ago on this, and that is... somebody said this. He said, do you remember that the Japanese businessman who bought a Picasso sketch? It wasn't even a painting, a Picasso sketch about 10 years ago, spent about $6.5 million on it, right? You've got to have a lot of money if you want to buy something, a Picasso sketch. So could you imagine he buys that and he puts it out on the front lawn of his estate somewhere? And then right out in front of the sun, and he just allows the entire public to come look at it, to be exposed to the sun, touch it. And would he do that? Of course not. He probably has an art gallery in his estate. He probably has a Picasso wing, and he probably has banisters and, you know, the right lighting, and it's behind a plastic protective cover. He probably has security with video cameras and that sort of thing. And he allows his guests to come through and to look at it. Now, would you say that that person is prudish about art? Would you? Of course not. Because he recognizes it's a gift. It's extremely valuable, so you need to protect it. And that's what the Bible is saying about sex. And so you need to help people to understand the Bible is not prudish about sex. The Bible is pro-sex in the context of a monogamous, heterosexual, covenantal, committed marriage relationship between a husband and a wife. But on the other hand, So you talk too much about like that, about to these easily aroused single people in Boston, and they're getting all excited and say, oh. But you also need to know that the Bible does provide a boundaries for this reason. Right? It's to protect you. So you talk about these things. And then last couple of things, rootlessness. Ministry implications and ideas. Unlike baby boomers, younger generation folks appreciate the historic roots of the church. Liturgical renewal rather than purely contemporary worship. Now, that might not be the case in some of your settings, but when people come to our setting, people say, oh, you're kind of a younger generation, so you must be very relevant and hip and that sort of thing. And I say, well, I don't know what you mean by that. And they come and they're surprised because our church service is very liturgical. Our music is a little slightly progressive, but nevertheless, it's the worship, the elements, very, very typically traditional Presbyterian. Why? Because there's a rootlessness and people want to be rooted somewhere. And therefore, the importance of the opportunities for developing community. For some of these people, they've never been involved in sticky relationships. So we provide sticky relationships. And we get them involved in them. Cultivate membership culture and the like. And lastly, an openness to change, missional opportunities. If it's racially mixed and diverse, the conversion of worlds makes people move open to new ideas and cultures, right? 30 years ago, right, our church has two dominant cultures, white Anglo and Pan-Asian, about 10% of everything else, about 25 to 30 different ethnicities represented. It just means we're Boston, right? And 30 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to do this. You wouldn't have been able to have a non-Anglo individual pastoring a church that was racially mixed that way. And certainly not being able to lead the dominant culture. Right? It just, culturally, that was not as acceptable. But with this kind of effects of globalization and urbanality, there's an openness to change. But remember, that was more of a traditional phenomenon. We had that in the early church. That sort of cosmopolitan spirit. And lastly, mobility allows us to plant more churches and to be missional. That this urbanization and globalization, that these and mobility allow us to be able to be more missional and kingdom-minded. Okay, thank you for being here.